Welcome back to the Lyme Podcast. My name is Aaron Alexander, and this is a place that we bring together the world's leading experts in all things health and wellness to help you optimize your mind, body, and movement. Today's guest is return guest, Dr. Andy Galpin. He's a professor of kinesiology at California State University, Fullerton. He has a master's in human movement sciences and a PhD in human bioenergetics. And he's just a generally kind, sweet, brilliant human being that I'm very grateful to get to share conversations with and get to share with you guys. You might have seen him. He's done probably the most appearances and the longest appearances on the Huberman Lab podcast, and I'm very grateful to get to share the brilliant mind of Dr. Galpin with all of us here today. This conversation goes deep into exercise physiology, the cutting edge science around how to get gains, hypertrophy, how to improve strength, body composition. We get into some stuff around respiration and breath work and breathing patterns. We tap into sleep. This conversation is so rich. You're going to want to take notes. I'm probably going to listen to it again. I know that I will. And I'm just so grateful to get to share folks like Andy Galpin with y'all. Thank you again for subscribing. Thank you for sharing. Thank you for doing you. Let's get to it with my guy, Dr. Andy Galpin. All right, so specific breath practices that you would lean on if you were feeling overwhelmed.
Yeah, so for me personally, reading it internally is number one, self-awareness. And then if I have to, second step is just going the nose only, right? Making sure I'm not, right, sort of mouth breathing. And then really, if I need to, it would just be a simple inhale, 3 to 4 seconds for me personally. And then I don't even count the exhale. It's just basically long as you can. Typically 2 or 3 of those sequences is sufficient for me. But a lot of times I can get there again with just the restate, because one of the things I spend a lot of time on personally is letting my cognition be in charge, which is a way to say, hey, you're really irritated right now or upset. You need to not be. I don't need to manipulate the physiology if I can be in control cognitively, which is to say, hey, you're wired up right now. You need to bring it down.
It's like the observer.
100%, right? You're detaching, observing, and just saying, you're lethargic right now. You're not giving your best. You need to bring it. Or whatever the case is, right? And this is exactly what I use in my family situation, right? Or interaction with colleagues, whatever it is. You're in this state right now. Is that, that's not the state you want to be in. So fix it. And a lot, like almost always, that does it for me.
How does one cultivate the resources within the observer to be able to actually be able to like hold the pose of observation?
Yeah.
When shit is hitting the fan.
There is a excellent, I went to a course a number of years ago called Skill of Stress. This is dual, actually really interesting. It was Art of Breath one day and Skill of Stress the next day. This is Brian McKenzie and Emily Hightower. Brian did Art of Breath and Emily did Skill of Stress. And that's where I learned read and regulate. And that's great because I was like, wow, that's intuitively what I'm doing when I'm at my best self. But now I have the recognition that this is the way I go about it personally. So for me, and at that point, it's just practicing. And it is that point is of acknowledging even retroactively how to didn't perform like I wanted to yesterday or earlier today or whatever. Okay. Remember, next time, pay more attention. And then really it is, for me, that is sufficient. I'm able to, in those situations, be like, okay, you're here, you're there, wherever we don't want to be. It doesn't take much practice. It didn't take it much for me to be able to get in that state. So that's really all it was. You don't always win, of course.
Yeah. What's the objective definition of stress? Like, what is stress? It's a very nuanced concept.
Yeah. This would be the same as something like quality, which is nothing. Like there's no objective. You can take a biological definition of it. You could take a psychological definition of it. But the broad idea would be some sort of, actually, I think probably physics is the way to go. Some sort of force acting on an object. Now, from a physics perspective, it would be an actual force. From a psychological perspective, it would be an internal force, but it's nonetheless is a force acting on an object. It tends to have a negative connotation. That is certainly not the way to approach stress, right? It is what it is.
Yeah.
Like this is the same thing that is all positive, all negative.
It's like two sides of a coin.
Yeah. It's force acting on an object. That's how I define it.
Yeah. And so something that I'm interested in is specifically with muscle building, hypertrophy compared to strength and the nuance between that.
Mm-hmm.
Is bigger muscles translate to stronger muscles?
There is an overlap, but it's not 100%. So that curve is not 99. There's no, the correlation is not, it's not perfect, but it is certainly a Venn diagram such that generally bigger muscles are stronger, but certainly not always. And we have two very broad lines of evidence to make that a really easy to understand answer. You can also look at this from the perspective of actually the scientific literature, right? And so either you want to take this from just very easy, I don't need to understand any science, to let's look at the actual papers and stuff. I can answer it both ways and the answer will still be the same. So I'll just give you the quick version, such that if there was no relationship or a minimal relationship between muscle size and strength, we wouldn't have weight classes. And clearly we do. Look at any powerlifting sport, look at weightlifting sports. Those world records, in terms of how much they lift, they go up as you go up weight classes, period.
Sure.
Argument's over. Like, there we go. In addition, if you look at any other sport where force is helpful, sumo wrestling, of course, football, same thing. Bigger people tend to be stronger. But that's also not an absolute, right? So can you, within that, find someone who's smaller, who's stronger? Of course. So both of those are completely true. And now if we add on the research side of it, when we see a study done and the outcomes are strength and muscle size, there is almost always a relationship there, but that is certainly never a one-to-one. You cannot just look at muscle size and say, hey, great, that muscle is going to be stronger. The last thing I'll say maybe is this. You can actually, one of the things we do now is we have technology where we can run a full body MRI scan of somebody. And this is strictly for muscle size. So we can actually then come back and get a volumetric measurement of each individual muscle size throughout the entire body. This is not an MRI scan for cancer or things like that. This is not a DEXA scan. This is an actual MRI. Within that, then I can look specifically and look at the actual volume size of your right vastus lateralis compared to your left. I can look at your piriformis. I can look at your, you know, subscapularis. I can look at any muscle I want and look at the actual size. And that's great. What I'm looking there for there is a number of things, specifically massive asymmetries in size.
Yeah.
And that is telling, right? And so for example, I've had 5 surgeries on my right knee. All right. I just checked myself recently. I have about a 6% lower muscle size on my right VL than my left VL, which is clearly a protective mechanism I have. I don't use it as much over the last 20 years. And so that muscle is atrophied. But my physical strength is not that different between the two. And so there is clearly a relationship here, but there's not a one-to-one.
The analogy that comes to mind is it's not the size of the boat, it's the motion of the ocean.
Well, that's not totally true because the size of the boat matters too.
I just wanted to say.
Right? Because like the good example here is also... Look at like combat sports.
Mm-hmm.
So we would love to say things like technique.
Yeah.
But if you have somebody who's insanely stronger than you,
mm-hmm.
you can still lose.
What do you think of isometrics? What do you think of eccentrics? What do you think?
Love them all. I think both are underrated. I would say classically, even myself, I have done a insufficient job of both discussing mm-hmm. those as well as using them as a tool.
Yeah, they're interesting.
Yeah, way more effective.
It's not what you see.
Uh-uh.
Mm-mm.
It doesn't seem to be, for whatever reason, it just doesn't, people like to see the finished product, right? I want to know how much I can bench. I want to know how much I can squat, which watches the finish, right? But if you look at, again, the research on connective tissue would be a great place to start, but even just look at what people have classically done in the sports that you and I are involved with specifically, really in combat sports as well. Like there's a tremendous need for eccentric control. There's a tremendous need for isometric contraction.
Yeah.
And then even just in addition, if we're looking at correcting movement,
mm-hmm.
like moving well is many things, but one of the major components to moving well, however you define that for you and your situation, is control.
Mm-hmm.
That's eccentric. Can you be under control? Can you move when you want to move? And can you not move when you don't want to move? That is isometric and eccentric. So yeah, love them both and highly underrated.
What is the effect on muscle tissue in the concentric phase compared to the eccentric phase. From my bro understanding, you're going to have more micro trauma on the muscle in the eccentric phase. Is that just a product of being able to load more in the negative portion, or is it a product of the myosin-actin relationship being like ripped apart, or what's going on there?
A little bit of both. Generally, well, clearly you have...
What are myosin-actin? I'm just like throwing these words in.
Yeah, sure. There's a higher force production that happens potentially with eccentric actions. So the way that muscle contracts is you let's take your quad. The quad muscle, the front, your thigh muscle is actually four muscles. That's why I call it a quad.
Mm.
Right?
Now we know.
There you go. Each of those muscles is comprised of hundreds of thousands of muscle fibers, right? And so a typical muscle in your body is somewhere between 100 and 300,000 individual muscle fibers, plus or minus. You've got 600 to 700 muscles total in your body. So that puts you in the neighborhood of, I think, something like, quick math here, 150, 250 million fibers running around your body, something like that.
That's fast math, bro.
I hedged up and down a lot there. I gave myself a good spot. So each one of those muscle fibers, the way that it contracts is it has two what are called microfilaments. Micro meaning small filaments, and that's actin and myosin. And so the quick, really, explanation here is the myosin reach up and grab actin. The myosin come together, and what that does is it stacks them on top of itself. That's why the easiest example is to think about your biceps muscles. And if you're extended, your palm is up, your arm is reaching out, your palm is facing the sky, then those muscle fibers are far apart. And so you can imagine my fingers, I got all four fingers for those just listening, pointing at each other. So my middle fingers are touching. Okay, great. The height between my pinky and my pointer finger is whatever it is. If I were to smash those things together and my fingers slipped past each other, the height of my pointer finger and my pinky finger are now higher. It's a bigger peak. That's exactly what's happening in your biceps when you flex. Those actin and myosin are stacking on top of each other.
The guns.
Yeah.
Totally. That's what you're seeing.
Yeah, if you had anything there, that would have showed, but yeah.
Yeah, right, exactly. I received that.
So they're stacking on top of each other. And those are what we call your contractile filaments. Those are good at coming together, the concentric portion, but when you actually ask the muscle to lengthen under force, it's able to produce more force because it's effectively, I don't have to move anything. I just have to stop it from moving. And so my connection from the actin and the myosin is stronger than my ability to move them. Mm-hmm. And so I can resist force more than I can apply force.
Yeah,
is a quick way.
And so that makes sense to me why you're able to hold more weight. Is that exclusively the reason, or am I just being misguided that there is more gains to be had in the eccentric phase compared to the concentric?
There are not more gains to be had. Mm. It is more, there tends to be more soreness with eccentric action because you can load it more.
Yeah.
Now, there's a number of things happening there. There is some tissue damage, of course. There's some edema and some swelling and other stuff like that. But I wouldn't say more gains to be had is appropriate there. It is just an alternative method because we also know there's very little association between the amount of soreness you get and the amount of muscle hypertrophy that results. Mm. So those are not good correlates. Then they're not good. It's not a good way to identify whether or not you had an effective workout is how sore or not you got.
What's the working definition? And we'll come back to all this. What's the working definition right now in the world of science of what soreness is?
It would be all perceived. So you can measure this objectively via muscle size. So the typical way we'll do it is, let's say we would take an ultrasound image. You could use MRI, but most of the time you're going to use ultrasound because it's way cheaper. And we would get an actual measure of your muscle size, right? How thick is, how is the diameter? Then you would do about typically of a lot of eccentric stuff and you get a lot of damage in there. And the next day you'd measure that size. And the change in size is going to be representative of how much acute inflammation and water is in that tissue. Mm. And you'll see pronounced changes, right, of that. And so it's not an amount that could actually be an increase in contractile properties over 24-hour period.
Yeah,
it is clearly there. In addition, you would have how sore are you? There's actually scientific ways where you can imagine putting your leg in a cylinder, and that cylinder very slowly squeezes down, and then you would actually it's like a light pressure thing, and you'll say, okay, when do I start feeling sensations of discomfort? And yeah, you can rank that and without knowing the number. So it's a little bit, it is subjective, but it is better than just being like, I'm sore, 3 out of 10.
I mean, what are we saying about lactic acid and lactate? And like, what's like when you, the sensation, the perceived sensation of soreness at a biomolecular level, like the chemistry of that, what's happening?
Yeah. So what you're almost always talking about is nociceptors. It's pain receptors. It is a signaling thing. Lactate has no relationship whatsoever to muscle soreness. It has no relationship to muscle fatigue either. There's a relationship there, but it's not causal. In fact, it is anti-fatiguing. Mm. So the production of lactic acid is not really a thing. Lactate is there. Pedantic.
So why was that touted for so long as the standard?
Yeah, well, okay, two things.
And what's going to change next? I'm so frustrated with science. I'm so mad.
Well, remember now, this is not your fault, but I will say it's a learning opportunity.
Yeah.
Science is not a noun, it's a verb.
Yeah, of course.
Right? Like, this is an action, it's not a thing.
Unless you're Fauci. Fucking Fauci.
Well.
He owns it.
I'll let, yeah. Again, friends, it is a verb.
It's static and it's mine.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll let you comment on that. So remember, science is limited by your current capabilities. And so the original research, 1808, I think was the first, no, 1790, 1780 was the first description of lactate, came from sour milk, is honest reality. It was identified 1808, I'm pretty sure, is when they found the first actual lactate in tissue. This was in hunted stags, so deer in Europe, and they realized, well, there's a ton more of this lactate in these stags who had been hunted and sprinting and saving for the life with a lot of course stress and things like that. Handful of years later, it took for a while, really until the early 1920s to start identifying. Meyerhoff, Otto Meyerhoff, who won a Nobel Prize, 1907 was that paper, I believe. I bet you didn't know you're getting this kind of detail on lactate.
Bro, I'm stoked.
his paper, as well as A.B. Hill.
My hands are in the Eiffel Tower pyramid pose. That's how you know. I'm just taking it in.
Yeah.
You know?
Their work, they both won Nobel Prizes for basic understanding of metabolism. But one of the things at this point we realize is, all right, lactate is a byproduct of anaerobic metabolism. It is also generated in muscle with muscle contraction. None of those things were known before that. And there is a relationship there. There is an increase in lactate production with an increase in muscle contraction. That is a known phenomenon. What byproduct of that, the more you contract, the more lactate you create. The more you contract, the more fatigue you get. So that association is very strong. This is a classic example of misunderstanding causation and correlation. Mm-hmm. So they are highly correlated, but one is not causing. In fact, one of the things that we know, and in fact, there's a number of things that lactate has done, but anyone who's ever had like an IV, and you've had a Ringer solution. Ringer solutions have been around since the early 1900s. In 1930, they started putting lactate into Ringer solutions. Mm. The reason they do that is because it is an insanely effective way to buffer metabolic acidosis. Mm. Point right there. Like, why, if I'm metabolically acidosis, why am I getting an acid? Well, you're not. You're getting lactate that goes to the kidney. You're able to then generate bicarbonate, and then you actually bring acidic levels down. The brain is one of the most preferred fuel sources for the brain is lactate. Same with the heart. The heart is the number one consumer of lactate in your entire body. That more lactate is consumed in the heart than anywhere else. It loves it. Kidneys and liver are also huge fans of it. They're able to actually go through. So lactate is just half carbohydrate. That's all it is. You take glucose, split it in half, add some more chemistry to it. That's lactate. So if I take it back in the liver, put those two molecules back together, I just made glucose, which is an insanely effective fuel source. So they all love it. This is why the heart loves it. This is why the brain loves it. There's also actually a thing called an astrocyte. There's an astrocyte lactate shuttling theory, or hypothesis rather, which is your astrocytes. And this is, theory is a weak word for it, because it's very well established at this point, or hypothesis rather. Your astrocytes, which are most of the cells in your central nervous system, they absolutely love and will prefer lactate in many situations over anything else. So powering your nervous system, this is one of the many, many reasons why lactate is highly associated with memory, with cognition, with learning, with sepsis, with insulin regulation, with injury, with muscle function, with muscle hypertrophy. Like, you just go up and down the list, and lactate is positively associated. It's also why they're running multiple trials right now where they're giving people lactate immediately after a traumatic brain injury. To see if there's potentially any benefit there. Same thing with creatine. Creatine is true for all those things as well.
Yeah.
So that's really what lactate, and to answer your actual question, why those things were associated that way, they both went up, right? And it wasn't until we had way more advanced technology and chemistry to realize, oh, there's actually other issues that are happening there, and those just had to be associated. So you're generating more lactate as a way to buffer the additional acid production, which is really one of the contributors to fatigue, which there are many, many. But that's really what's happening with lactate.
So back to eccentrics and isometrics. Something I think that often lacks in training is specificity around the denser tissues, like the tendons, mm-hmm. ligaments. A lot of the stuff that we're doing, we're thinking of like just getting our like big muscle bags.
Yeah.
More to be more of them. And what you see in the NFL, for example, or many sports, is a lot of tendon and ligament injuries.
Oh, yeah.
How do we prevent that with training?
Yeah, you have four major buckets to think about. That this is how we approach soft tissue stuff. You can't take that risk to zero. you certainly are aware of that, right? No matter what you do, there is going to be an inherent risk.
Yeah.
That's just what it is. So it's all about risk reduction. And then you just cross your fingers.
Sure.
At that point, right? Pray to your deity or whatever. Sacrifice a goat. I don't care. You just hope on luck, right? That's the best you can do. All right. Four major buckets. There is a relationship between overall sleep quality. And I'll go through these really quickly because you asked about training. We'll spend most of our time there.
Sleep's a massive one.
It is a strong correlation there. So especially now there's actually interesting data. There's one particular study I'm thinking of, meta-analysis, that looked at, it was over 52 weeks, so almost a year. And they included, I think it was like 16 or 18 different sports and hundreds of people in this study. And one of the things that you'll see happen is an increase in injury risk during increased training, load and volume and intensity, training camp, things like that. And that's obvious. You're coming in from a state of low training for the most part, and you're ramping it up in competition. It's uncontrolled, etc. Injury risk goes up. Okay, no problem. At the same time, we also know sleep is reduced in periods of higher training. That just happens. We also know sleep independently is not a super strong, admittedly. There is a somewhat of a relationship, but it's not incredibly strong between sleep and injury, especially if...
I think the coordination component of it is it's probably hard to identify and isolate, but I think that there's like a massive component where you're just generally a little bit more off.
Well, there is quantified.
The likelihood of something combusting.
There's data on that too. We know those numbers for the most part, which I can cover in a second. But the problem is you're combining all those factors in training camp.
Sure.
And so when you do that, your risk of injury in training camps, depending on the paper you want to look at, it's somewhere between like 1.5 to 4 times higher, right? So you can't do anything about the additional training load. You have to go through that. But one of the things you can take action on is the sleep side. That's why I bring it up.
Say it again. What makes
so when you if you go into higher? Like the combination of intensified training,
yeah,
higher training volume combined with excessive reduction in sleep,
yeah, for sure,
that's all going to come together and cause a problem. And since you can't do anything about the training load or intensity, because that's typically dictated by your coach, or you just have to get the miles in, or you have to get the volume on, or whatever, you can reduce that risk somewhat by making sure that the sleep is as high as humanly possible. And this is an important distinction here. We'll go right. I said I was going to go fast. I didn't.
It's okay.
There is a major difference between chronic sleep deprivation, total sleep deprivation. So now you're talking like you literally went 48 hours without sleep. I'm not referring to that research at all. It's not really, that's cool for military and some other things we've done. There's also a difference between extreme sleep restriction. So 3 hours a night, 4 hours a night. All the stuff I'm referring to is the difference between 7 hours and 8+. It's that level of distinction. There's lots of research on 7 hours and 30 minutes versus more than 7 hours and 30 minutes. There's tons of research on going from 8 to 10, and almost all of these papers in high performing individuals are going to show significant improvements in a number of areas going from that 7.5, 8 line to higher. That's really what I'm referring to.
And then is there, and I continue to knock you off center. I apologize, but is
your show,
seven,
bro.
Is 7.5 hours better than 7 hours and 45 minutes because of whatever they call it, sleep inertia, because you're entering into a 90-minute sleep cycle?
Yeah, the sleep cycling stuff is not nearly as important. If you're asking, so here's a couple of, there
what
are...
I've heard is like sleep in 90-minute chunks. So 7.5 hours, yeah, or jump to 9 hours.
I don't believe that at all.
Doesn't seem to make a ton of sense.
Makes no sense. No. Yeah. And I can tell you why. We're way off track, but...
We're coming back.
Sleep stages in general are completely screwy,
yeah,
and completely misunderstood. One of the worst things you can do for your sleep, that's aggressive. A bad thing you can do for your sleep is try to influence or hack your sleep stages. I could do a, I could give a very long time why you don't want any part of messing with those stages. Stay away from that. Not a good way to go about it. Also stay away.
What does that mean to hack your stages? I mean, I could take some guesses at what you mean, but.
So a lot of people are very concerned with their trackers telling them that they have X amount of time in a certain sleep stage.
Mm-hmm.
And for a multitude of reasons, that it is a bad reason to be concerned about how you're sleeping.
Yeah. So you mean like an alarm waking you up at a specific time due to.
No, what I mean is someone being like, I'm looking at my tracker and I only got 40 minutes of deep sleep.
Mm.
Therefore, I'm going to go take a specific supplement that helps with deep sleep. Very bad idea.
I understand.
For many reasons. Same thing with REM or even what you mentioned, like, if I'm not going to get more than 90 to stop now.
Right.
You should not do any of those things for just many reasons.
Interesting.
To get past that. I would avoid that strongly.
Okay.
There are at least 5 papers that I'm aware of from, and this is nice because they're all from different labs.
Yeah.
Right, which is always like a strong suit of science. When you have multiple aims showing the same thing from multiple groups of scientists, your likelihood of screwy or like inadvertent or covert, either way, just happening, it's just stronger evidence to go off of.
Yeah.
So you're looking at papers, a handful out of Stanford on swimmers and Division I basketball players, elite cyclists. There have been rugby studies. There have been tennis players, well, all high performing individuals. All this stuff is what we generally call sleep extension research. And so you're taking people already sleeping a decent amount and you're adding somewhere between 45 minutes to 2 hours of sleep per night. Those studies range from as little as like 3 days all the way up to 5 to 7 weeks. Across the board, you're talking about in the basketball study, 9% improvements in free throw percentage, 3-point percentage, significant improvements in reaction time over the course. Now, all these studies have limitations, lack of control groups, like blah, 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 but hard to do research on Division I professional athletes. So like, think about the broader context, especially when all these are pointing the same direction. Improvements of body composition, aerobic capacity, reaction time, you mentioned, mood, perceived sleepiness, fatigue, all of these things. Endurance has also been improved in all these studies. Tennis serving accuracy, swimming accuracy, swimming importance, like you, across the board. Going from moderate 7 to 8 hours of sleep to 9 to 10 just continues to improve things in many people. Mm. It's probably not going to last forever. You all probably don't need to be sleeping 9 to 10 hours a night permanently. But this is this is what I spend my time on. It's not, I don't do anything health related. I can't make any comments about, well, do you need to sleep more than 9 hours to reduce your risk of heart attack 45 years later? I don't fucking know.
Yeah, I'm sure it varies wildly.
Probably doesn't matter.
Wildly.
It's probably fine. As long as you're getting like enough, you're probably fine.
And it's based on your output as well, I'd imagine.
Well, so there's no data actually on energy expenditure and sleep duration.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to matter that much.
Hmm.
But there's clearly something there.
It's got to be something there.
Like, so I don't think people have really, really unpacked, like, what is that Venn diagram? Is it 10%?
Probably a lot of, and this gets, you know, a little bit more into the weeds as well, but I think a lot of it has to do with where you're deriving energy in your daily life. Like, are you getting adequate access to the sun? Are you getting adequate access to the earth? Like, what's, like, your bioelectric state throughout the day? Or are you sitting on top of a penthouse suite and you're getting just bombarded by various different forms of radiation.
And, yeah, I can't speak
to... And you're anxious and you're stressed and there's all these internal kind of gears that are like parasitic gears that are running within you, which is hard to isolate all of that.
Yeah.
It comes into more just conversation, but it seems like there's a lot there in my feeling.
Yeah, I can't speak to any data on any of that, but what is clear is this is why you shouldn't try to mess with your sleep stages.
Mm-hmm.
Because the assumption that the amount of deep sleep you have or your 90-minute rhythms, the assumption that those are supposed to be the same every day is totally screwy, right? We would not expect the same nutrition plan every day if we have different activity levels.
Right.
You wouldn't have the same restoration and recovery. You wouldn't have the same breath work. You wouldn't have the same movement. You would not have the same training.
Or HRV.
None of that.
Yeah.
But why would you expect then your sleep stages to be the same?
Right.
It doesn't make any sense, right? Your sleep duration. Your sleep time, how much your brain will auto-regulate how much time it wants to spend in each of those different phases. Let it do what it wants to do for the most part. It's doing it for a reason. For any of the reasons you mentioned, for exercise, for anything else, it knows what it needs to recover from based on your demand.
Mm.
Let it run its course.
So going back to specific
Our four
injury prevention.
Okay.
And with sleep though, is there any data that suggests that a lack, like an acute lack of sleep, has any degradation on the quality of connective tissue at a structural level?
Acute as in a single night? Generally, no.
Okay.
It seems to be okay. So a single night of bad sleep doesn't seem to matter that much. Now you can do that with a couple of things. You can do this with extreme sleep deprivation. You're talking literally 48 straight hours, things like that. But if you kind of had a crummy night of sleep, I slept horribly last night. I'm fine. I'm not concerned about what's happening. Yeah.
We're in this together, bro.
Mine was self-induced.
Nice.
To put it that way.
Nice.
I'm in Austin. I had a 5+ hour podcast marathon yesterday.
There you go.
I ate an obnoxious amount of barbecue.
Good for
and enjoyed every second of it. And I washed it all down with bourbon and it was amazing.
I like that.
So I earned my sleep last night.
I smoked a bunch of meth and went to the titty bar.
same. To each our own.
Same.
It was great, but
yeah.
Price is paid.
Nice.
But yeah, not a huge concern typically that a single night is really going to put us in a bad spot. It's also, dude, you want to be a little more resilient than that, ideally, right?
Like, what do you say? Don't be a snowflake.
Don't be precious.
Don't be pansy. Don't be precious.
Don't be precious, man.
Don't be fucking precious, bro.
No.
Like, get over yourself, bro.
Live life a little bit, right? Like, I'm certainly not eating 4 beef ribs or whatever and drinking bourbon very often, but I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I need to be able to perform today, right?
I read something a while ago that a single night of disrupted sleep can actually be facilitative in your body, I think, like producing more growth hormone or something, like almost as like a hermetic response of like, oh shit, like this person doesn't live a precious life. We need to
kind
of be prepared.
Yeah.
Is there anything to that of like, if you have the perfect, you sleep 9 hours, you have a little silk lavender eye mask every night, you do all the things, and then suddenly you have one night where like,
yeah,
shit, I only slept for 6 hours because I stayed out late and we danced and we went crazy and
sure.
It was wild. And then I had a wild night. Like, is there any kind of like eustress in that for the body potentially?
Yeah. Any single change in like growth hormone release over a single day is not relevant really for the most part. It's not going to, you have to have so much so consistently for it to matter. Wouldn't concern. However, you're onto a greater point, which is that one of the things that we do and we make very clear when people come in to work with us on sleep, like I'm not trying to make you the best sleeper. I want you to be the most resilient sleeper. That is our primary goal. And that's a really big reframing. This is not optimizing your sleep because it ends up being exactly what you just said. And then people that travel or have anything happening, it's like all of a sudden your sleep tanks.
Yeah.
And now you feel horrible for days, blah, blah, blah. I don't want that at all. I want you to be insanely resilient. So I want you to be able to sleep at a high level, maximally effective sleep in multiple situations and scenarios. Everyone I work with is considered to be a high performer, either by me or by them.
Mm-hmm.
Athletes, non-athletes, executive, whatever, you come in, I don't care if you have a job or not, like you come into our program, it's high performance. This is it, right? I don't need anything else. So you're a high performer. Yeah. You need to look a certain way. You need to feel a certain way. You need to perform a certain way. Whatever those three definitions mean to you, that's your definition. I don't care. You want to be able to do X thing per day. Okay, great. Tell me what you need to get done. Now we're going to make you resilient to that so that you can perform and execute under any situation scenario in your life that becomes present. So we want to make people highly resilient sleepers. Which means you have to be effective and you have to know how do you set things up so that you don't have major pitfalls, but we need to be resilient against those things. So you don't end up in the Wyoming mountains hunting mule deer and all of a sudden you're like, oh, I don't have my 8 sleep. I can't sleep tonight.
Yeah, right.
That's not a good situation to be in for most people.
Sure. Yeah.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. I'm very excited about BetterHelp as a sponsor for the podcast because I'm very excited about therapy. And that's exactly what BetterHelp does. They are an online platform that provides skilled, licensed therapists for you. So you fill out a simple questionnaire telling about yourself, telling about what you're looking for, and some of the things that you're experiencing, some of the things that you'd like to move through, some of the things that you'd like to learn, anything that you might be seeking in guidance or communication with a skilled therapist. And then they set you up with various different potential therapists. There is absolutely no charge to switch.
So that's something that's really important with therapy. You really want to find someone that you like. I've been working with a therapist remotely for the last 2 years, and it has been one of the best things that I've ever done. And I would recommend to anyone that would like to develop a deeper understanding of themselves to be able to show up better in relationship within their business, for their partner, for their family, for themselves. I think therapy is just so invaluable, and I'm so grateful for BetterHelp because they take the headache out of finding the best fit therapist for you. And also, on top of that, if you would like to get 10% off your first month, BetterHelp is offering that to you by going to betterhelp.com/alignpod. That's better, BETTER, help, help.com/alignpod, ALIGN. Pod. 10% off your first month. And if you don't absolutely love your therapist, you can switch up and date around and find the perfect fit for you at betterhelp.com/alignpod. All right. So the other four factors in injury prevention.
That's number one. Second one is hydration. This one's very simple. Making sure hydration is adequate. Lot to say there, but I just think maybe in the interest of time, we'll cruise past that. But that's a very important one as well.
Well, can we touch a little bit on what is the constitution of water look like? Is it distilled water? Are we going to be adding some sodium in there, some potassium?
Well, this entirely depends on your biochemistry. This is what I would never, I personally in our system would never work with anybody unless we have extensive biomarkers. Our system is really comprehensive. We take a obnoxious amount of blood.
What is your company called?
I have a number of them. We have Absolute Rest as our sleep company.
Yeah.
If you want to just do sleep. Our high performance blood work company is called Vitality Blueprint. And then our full immersion coaching program is called Rapid Health and Performance.
Cool. We can include the links for all of that.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you for that. Yeah. The reason I'm saying that is now, if it's something as simple as like drink more water, it's fine. Like you're not running into that much risk there. That said, I don't know, 10, 15% of people I've worked with are excessively hyperhydrating. And this is associated with almost all the things related to dehydration as well. We've had a handful, not many, maybe four, something like that, of people who have paid full price coming in for like this very extensive programs. And it very quickly we're like, oh yeah, your brain fog, your headaches, your poor sleep, your lack of energy, your low libido, all these things, like you thought you had some crazy micronutrient imbalance or some huge problem going on, and you are slightly hyponatremic. You're drinking way too much pure water. All we do, like day one, cut water intake back, and all of a sudden everything goes away. Like in many cases, literally like day one, day two.
What about, is there accuracy to if you are drinking excessive, say distilled water, where it's been stripped of any type of mineral content, then your body will then end up utilizing minerals from itself, from bones or wherever it's going to garner minerals from in order to make that water, I don't know what the term would be, bioavailable perhaps?
No, I mean, kind of, but not per se. That's not really what's happening.
What's really happening?
Because all your food matters too.
Yeah, right.
So
it's like overall levels.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. One of the things you want to pay attention to, this is why we would like for sure test all your sweat. I want to know what exactly is coming out. Reason I'm saying this is there's times when distilled water is fine. Like I'm not really going to be honestly going out of my way to make sure people have distilled water, with the exception of really specific scenarios like during weight cuts and stuff like that for sport performance when we're intentionally trying to manipulate sodium.
Don't hold on to anything.
Yeah. There's some things there. But the reality of it is I want to know like hydration status in your blood. I can differentiate between acute and chronic dehydration in your blood.
So really, if you're doing a weight cut, distilled water is a clever trick because you're not going to be, your cells aren't going to get as
It depends. It really depends on how we're going about it. Remember, this is all like fairly complicated because like I can measure, if I know your hematocrit, hemoglobin, I know your sodium. I can use those things. If those all hematocrit, hemoglobin, sodium, they all start trending upwards, then I have a pretty good sign of acute dehydration. Not a big deal. Maybe just dehydrated the day of the blood draw. However, we throw albumin in there. If that starts trending high as well, I have a really good indicator of chronic dehydration. I can see those things. If they're all in the opposite direction, I can see the opposite. I can also then go look at sodium potassium ratios. that's going to give me a strong indicator of global persistent fatigue. And so now when we're starting to have complaints, I can look at those things and tease out, is this a hydration issue or is this not related to hydration? This is something else. I also pay attention to the cortisol symptomology, and we can understand what is happening, measure urine rate and go, okay, great. You can go add more salt here. You can make sure we have minerals in our water. And you might, and this is a classic example. If anyone's ever gone like, man, I increased my sodium intake and I felt way better. There's a very strong indicator here that what you're really doing is hacking the system inappropriately. You haven't actually figured out why that sodium is low. When your sodium is low, in an extreme example, you're talking someone who's got like a 20 to 1 sodium to potassium ratio. You can figure this out if you ever had blood work done. Go calculate it really fast. Look up Addison's disease. Addison's disease is chronic low cortisol. It's very low energy, very high fatigue. Low. If you have a bunch of salt, that number goes up. You get back in a normal physiological range. You feel way better. It was not an issue though of low salt.
But it might be curing a symptom.
The reason you're having low salt is because that is that's in a response to chronically low cortisol, which is in response to something else. You didn't solve the problem. You're smashing like 4 grams of sodium electrolytes a day.
Right.
That's not the issue. The issue is why is your kidney doing that in the first place? Why is it excreting so much there? So the reason why I'm saying this to your question is, what am I putting in my electrolyte solution? Well, what problem am I solving?
Right.
It might be for somebody like, you know, pure water. Again, I'm really never having someone have distilled water, but I also may not need, and sometimes it's actually detrimental to go add salt to somebody if we're in the opposite direction. So the opposite direction, Cushing disease, really, really, really high. This is now going to, really high sodium in your blood is going to cause you to retain total volume, blood volume. This is then going to have high blood pressure. So this is the opposite. This is red face. This is high blood pressure. This is high cholesterol. This is like high Cushing's disease.
So if you're just a generally, you know, healthy-ish dude or gal, what, we get a little bag of Redmond sea salt and just kind of toss it in some food?
Yeah.
Maybe a little pinch in water in the morning every now and again.
Why this matters is I'm not an MD. I don't do anything medical. Mm-hmm. So if you have Addison's or Cushing's, I'm not working with, you got to go there.
Yeah.
What I deal with is I feel good, but not great.
Yeah, right. That's what I'm.
That's distinction is what I'm talking about. I want to know all those levels so I don't have to go, just add some sea salt.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no. This is exactly what you need.
Yeah.
Question over. Right? You're taking this specific electrolyte. This is exactly where you're at in your physiology. And this is exactly what we're doing. If you want like a very broad answer, if you're eating mostly whole real foods and you're salting those things to taste, you're generally pretty good.
Probably
spot.
Fine, yeah.
Yeah. Now, one last important point here. We have dealt with this problem a much more than the opposite problem of undersalt. When people go from a traditional or bad, a normal, common diet, and then they decide to get really healthy, and they switched from all that food into real whole foods, but they don't add in salt. You've gone from now a daily consumption of 10 or 12 or 14 grams of salt a day down to 1. And it's just gone, and you didn't think, you got to add back all that salt that came in all that packaged and processed food that you've left off the table. And so this is a really big key. And so a really, really important thing we always stress is if you've really made changes to your diet and you're eating, again, more mostly whole real foods, make sure you salt them.
Yeah. I think there's a balance between becoming excessively myopic and excessively aware.
Totally.
Of yourself, where of you're course. Like, okay, now I'm juggling all these variables and my albumin and my, like, all these different concepts. And,
sure.
You know, do I have Cushing's disease? Or like, it's like so much. And I think a person can venture into almost like the iatrogenic disease realm,
yep,
in a way where it's like, this human experience is just too much to hold. Like, maybe just forget all of that.
Yeah.
And just go take a walk with your dog.
Totally.
Drink a little glass of water, breathe.
Yeah.
Play a little Ultimate Frisbee.
What we
have
tell,
a peanut butter sandwich.
What like, we you're tell good, everybody,
you're good.
The end of my coaching, it all ends in the same spot.
Yeah.
It ends with you eating decent food.
Yeah.
Somewhat paying attention, but not that much.
Yeah.
You move your body. You get out in the sun. You have great relationships with people, and you do something that you find purposeful.
Yeah, you gotta feel purposeful.
That's where I'm going.
Like, how do we feel excited when we wake up in the morning?
Yeah. I feel like if I can get these, what we call performance anchors, these are non-specific hidden stressors a lot of the times. So these are things that are adding stress to your system that you are not aware of, that is not pointing you in the right direction. We started off by asking about stress. So stress is needed for adaptation, right? It's also needed for maintenance, right? If we don't have stress, things go away. So if you're living a great life and you're in a great position, no, you're good. You still have to have some stress to maintain that. Okay, awesome. That's phenomenal. I just want to take away any stressor that is not there with intent, right? You may be visible and aware of that. We call those visible stressors. These are things you see and feel. What are you eating? What are you drinking? Like, what is your sleep? And are you not moving? Things like that.
Sure.
Then you have a whole subset of hidden stressors. You're applying same or greater stress to the system that you are not aware of. I just want to remove those things and then get the fuck out of the way.
Yeah.
Let your physiology run where it wants to run. It is always, always like smarter than
us. Your task is not to find love. It's to remove the barriers blocking you from experiencing it.
Yeah.
That's like paraphrased from somebody, but it's like you're reaching out for the thing. It's like, maybe just stop blocking yourself.
That's literally what we're doing. And then we are getting out of the way of physiology. And that's why I said at the end of our stuff is the goal I'm going to is that if I can just get all those things out of your way and you don't have to be on 25 supplements and have a restrictive diet and a specific daily, like, I don't want any of those things. That's the best place possible to be in.
Yeah, I think a lot of times when someone goes overboard with supplements, like I might fall into this category, it's like they're actually, you mentioned before, there's like a deeper layer of what's happening. I think a lot of that times it's a person that's experiencing some type of like obsessive compulsive relationship with their food consumptions or the supplementation. It's like they're actually at a deep subconscious emotional, mental emotional level, they feel out of control.
Yeah.
And they're seeking control anywhere they can find it. Like, they latched onto health, you know? And it's like, but there's still that kind of like parasitic emotional tension that's creating a pool. And this, again, it gets out of the world of like science and data. So it's kind of harder for, I think, to.
Yeah. Not my expertise at all.
But does that resonate? You know, like something like your relationship to food, your relationship to training, your relationship to supplementation.
Okay. I can comment on something like this. Think about respiratory rate. All right. So how much you're breathing, right? How much you're ventilating. There is a no short number of times we've seen this. And we actually spent a lot of time on this. This is great work. Brian McKenzie has a lot of stuff on this, as well as Martin McFeely. Phenomenal stuff on this. I think they've got some webinars or something up. You could check this out. But think about it this way. If you are overventilating, so you're breathing too much, you're hyperventilating. Here's what's kind of happening. I'll skip a lot of the physiology and science, but I'm looking for 15 breaths per minute. Okay. When I start seeing people at 14 to 15 breaths per minute overnight ventilation rate, I'm starting to get concerned, right? At 13, I'm taking action. These numbers should be 12 to 10-ish. Okay. Now, if you look at the science, it's going to say 12 to 20 is normal. And I don't think I need to explain to you and your audience why, like, reference ranges for what we're all trying to go after are really bad ideas. I don't give a rat shit about that reference range.
Yeah, sure.
100%. And there's extensive data on this. North of 15, especially north of 16 breaths per minute, are strongly associated with negative health outcomes. Okay. If 16 is bad for me clinically, I don't want to be 15.5 either. Like, we want to be away from that. Now, one of the things that happens with that is when you hyperventilate, what you're doing, and it could be one of three things. It could be biomechanical. So your breathing mechanics are bad. Mm. It could be pattern recognition. I'll come back to that. And that's exactly what you're really asking. And the third, it could be biochemistry. Mm-hmm. And so really, really briefly on that, you spent a ton of time, and anyone who's listening to the show, like, you've probably covered mechanics extensively.
Yeah.
We'll skip past that. Biochemically, what you're generally looking at is CO2.
Yeah. The Bohr effect.
Well, you're going to screw the Bohr effect by doing this.
Yeah.
Right. And so CO2, increases in CO2 are the primary bidirectional relationship we have to engage psychology and physiology back and forth.
Mm.
This is the lever you're pulling, right? So psychological stressors can act upon physiology via carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide from tissue can tell the brain and psychology what's happening. This is one of the ways you regulate up and down parasympathetic, sympathetic CO2. If you are overly sensitive to CO2, again, this would just be in the case of biochemical. This gives you the air hunger sensation, which means you have the sensation to breathe. If you're breathing at a rate that your respiratory rate no longer matches metabolic demand, right? You're overbreathing. Then you feel a certain way because hypocapnia has happened. CO2 concentrations have gotten too low. This puts you in respiratory alkalosis, which then causes the kidneys to put you into metabolic acidosis. Mm. This is a balance. In fact, there's great research, lots of papers on a lot of diagnosed metabolic acidosis is improperly diagnosed and is actually respiratory alkalosis.
And that causes red blood cells become stingy with holding on to oxygen as well.
The metabolic acidosis is not the problem, but the hypocapnia is. So the drop of CO2 causes it, and it's a little bit counterintuitive. Which becomes a
self-perpetuating issue because now you're hungrier for air and you feel like you're starving.
100%. So it actually keeps the red blood cells attached to, or the oxygen attached to red blood cells.
Yeah.
Which is actually one of the things albumin's doing, by the way. Mm. But nonetheless, so you're not getting
You love albumin, bro.
It represents like 60% of the osmotic pressure in your vessels. It's pretty important. So we're not getting actual oxygen into tissue. And I'm circling back to your point here, I promise, in a second here. Yeah. I think you're going to like this a lot.
Yeah.
So that becomes a huge problem. That's a chemical response. Now, why did you start overbreathing in the first place? Well, hyperventilation is a known response. It is a good response to CO2 buildup. So you start exercising, CO2 builds up, you start breathing more. That's what's supposed to happen, right? Could be a psychological thing as well. You and I are probably hyperventilating right now, mildly. We're excited. We're interested. Haven't seen each other in a while. Like, great conversation.
I'm rock hard right now, bro.
Yeah. Great. Fantastic. So great. This is a positive association. However, when this is done chronically, this becomes a problem for the things I just mentioned. All right. Now, if I'm doing that at night, even mildly, 15, 16 breaths per minute, I'm in that consistent hypocapnic state, which means HRV is going to get lowered because I'm slightly sympathetic. We start having latency issues, can't fall asleep as well. Waking up, this is common for people, like I wake up, and when I wake up, I can't go back to sleep.
Sure.
Things like that, right? So we can cover that. These people tend to feel the best when they're doing very low level activity. The reason why, if you're breathing 15, 16 breaths per minute, sleeping, and now you start walking, you do endurance exercise, you go for a run and you feel bliss, you feel amazing. These people tend to not be able to, like, I can't miss a day of training. I can't not work out today. I feel anxious. I feel horrible if I don't move something today. It's because you're now finally having your respiratory rate match your metabolic rate. And now you feel normal. Your CO2 concentrations are actually equal.
Interesting. It's like growing up in an abusive household and then finding an abusive relationship to feel like, as an adult.
That's a bit, maybe.
You're like, homeostasis. This is what I know.
100%. And so someone like you said earlier is like, there's maybe that negative relationship there. These are people, when you take training away, things go bad.
Oh, they freak out.
They freak out.
Wow.
That's, they don't know it. But a lot of, it's not always, but you go look at the respiratory rate and you're like, oh yeah. Yeah. You overbreathe.
Mm.
That's why they freak out. That's why they have that tie, that relationship, that like, I have to do these things, right?
Oh, so they're like, they want their breathing cadence in a way to match their
energy, like
their structural mechanical output.
Yeah.
And there's like a mismatch when you're just sitting there kind of working out.
100%.
Whoa.
So now, like, that's, you have this huge urge and desire to go for a run. Oh. To go do a thing, right?
Right.
And you feel most normal.
Because you're always idling at like 2,300.
Bingo.
You're like, bro, tone it down.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're making me anxious.
Yeah. The opposite can happen too, by the way. You have people that have, and this is way less common. What we described is fairly, very common actually. If you have people that have really high HRVs, really, really super parasympathetic, breath rate is really low, sub 10 seconds, right? And they're experiencing, oh man, I just can't get it to move, lethargy, depressed, no motivation. If you give that person down regulation stuff, you've just put them in a world of shit.
Mm.
You've made that whole situation off. This is one of the major problems we've seen with people that are super into breath work and even down regulation, herbs, nutrition, all these things, right? It's like that is an overly downregulated physiology. What the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
You're going to make this person's life way worse.
Need some firecrackers.
Yeah. You need like the opposite direction here, right?
Some smelling salts.
Yeah. Let's rip smelling salts and get after it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the closest comment I could make.
What's the third thing? Because we're coming down on time.
Okay.
Son of a bitch. I wish we had 5 hours.
Well, if you would have got here on time, we would have.
I know, bro. I dropped the ball today.
No, your airplane. If you had been here last night, we had unlimited
yesterday.
Time.
Yesterday. Dude, that was messed up. Security stopped me at the airport for 45 minutes because I had a guided PEMF device. And they're like, we've never seen anything like this. And so they just held me until the bomb person came. And I just literally watched my flight fly away as I'm standing there with my PEMF device.
You're one of those guys disarray. That gets to the airport 30 minutes before your flight, don't you?
Yeah, but it should be fine.
Classic.
All right, what's the third
Classic.
Thing? What's the third thing?
Sleep, hydration are two biggest components. Then we have overall nutrition, right? We need to understand micronutrient profile. What is going on? There are hard, it is
they
hard.
Stopped me for 45 minutes, Galpin.
Dude, bro, I would have been doing some serious reading and regulating at that point.
I needed some long, like, USA breaths.
This is when you have, to me, I'd have been having, like, existential talks with myself, which is, like, I'd have been pulling out the, well, maybe you'll miss your flight, and then maybe you'll miss this thing, and then, but then maybe, like, something else will happen to be, like.
Dude, what happens when someone's psyche fractures?
I don't know. You tell me. Sounds like
I was there, man.
So infuriating.
God dang it.
Human experience. It's beautiful.
All right.
It's a beautiful struggle. Right.
Third thing. Sorry.
Life is beautiful. Life is brutal, but beautiful.
All right. Tell me about albumin.
We'll go past nutrition quickly. Just because of our total time here.
Yeah.
But this is really important. So then the fourth thing would really be training. And so getting into making sure we can develop tissue tolerance is critically important. Much easier. Skeletal muscle is one of the most plastic, meaning like adaptable tissues in all of biology. It's insane. The thing that, so remember all of biology in cells, every individual cell has a nucleus. The nucleus is what holds your DNA, right? This is what holds all your genes. This is what controls replication, cell death, cell growth, repair, all of it. In skeletal muscle in humans, you have thousands of those nuclei, right? In most of biology, it's one-to-one. One nuclei per one cell. You have thousands. Like you could have 3,000-4,000 nuclei, which, again, to run some quick math, that would be ballpark it, 500 billion nuclei in your body.
That's fast math.
Something like that. That's to say, it is your skeletal muscle is almost optimized, one could say, for adaptability. Tissue is not, right? Connective tissue, soft tissue is not supposed to be there. It is there for force transmission.
Right.
The way you move throughout this world is you move bones. The way that you move bones is you have connective tissue. Connective tissue attaches to muscle. Central nervous system sends a signal. Muscle contracts. That pulls on connective tissue. That moves bone. That moves you. So at the end of the day, that is it. Blood flow, of course, is extremely minimal in connective tissue and soft tissue. It's there. That doesn't mean it doesn't respond to training. It just needs different training. And this is really where isometrics, particularly 30 seconds plus of contractions, is the most we know. Mm-hmm. Their eccentrics are phenomenal as well.
A big part of that is because you're able to actually load the tissue more, which is going to distribute that weight out of the muscle belly and into the harder, denser tissues.
It just needs a long time. The way that...
Is that wrong, what I just said?
It's not percent particularly wrong. It would be a little bit of a...
Is it a little wrong?
It's a little wrong.
Nice.
It's whatever. There's a logical fallacy called the fallacy, which is...
You just made that up.
No, I didn't. It's legit. There's actually different... All these fallacies have different terms for them, or different names, rather. But it's the idea that just because you explain something slightly wrong doesn't actually mean the thing is wrong itself.
Yeah.
So exactly what you said, like, is the physiology perfect? No. But are you at the right exact endpoint point? Yeah, for sure. It needs to be loaded.
Well, I'd imagine a part of that as well with longer duration, then the muscle bellies would start to get tired, which is also going to transmit more force into the tendons.
No, because
that is wrong.
No, that's wrong, totally wrong.
God dang it, Galpin.
Remember, the tendons don't actually do anything. There's no force transmission there. So if you lose force transmission in muscle, then you lose force, period. There's nothing else to make force other than the muscle. So when that force production goes down, then force compression goes down.
Interesting. There's no contractile tissues in the tendon.
No, none at all. None whatsoever. It's just a rubber band.
It's a rubber band.
It's only responding to what you're putting on it.
Wildly important rubber band for force transmission and like athleticism.
It is the entire thing. Yeah, it doesn't matter what your muscle can do at all if it's not transferred.
It's like the elastic load or like the recoil from sprinting. Like when you're going into that contra lateral motion. You're kind of like loading, you're opening up the left hip and opening up the right shoulder. That elastic recoil, it retains something, some absurd percentage of your energy. It's like 80%, 90% or something like this. You kind of like spring yourself back into that position.
Not even kind of, like it's 100% what's happening.
Yeah. So that's now we're talking tendons. And we're talking muscles as like, you know, distribution lines.
You know,
but like if you can get your body into that point, that's when you're going to start conserving a lot more energy and start moving a lot more fluidly.
Totally.
And becoming like a, you know, an elite athlete.
It's not necessarily just even tendons. Remember, each one of those muscle fibers I talked about is wrapped in connective tissue.
Yeah, sure.
Each one of those are wrapped in bundles. That is all wrapped in your muscle. That is all wrapped itself. That all then comes together to make a tendon. That tendon then puts on bone. So it is not even necessarily just the tendon. It is also the connective tissue in the actual muscle fibers, the muscle belly, mm-hmm. The epimysum. All that is contributing to force production. Mm-hmm. The way that your fibers are stacked, the way that it is oriented to your bone, that's called pennation angle. So the angle at which your muscle fibers enter and access the bone. All of this determines speed as well as force production. And so 100%, you can generally think of human movement as function of two basic properties. What can the skeletal muscle fibers themselves contract, and then how much force can be transmitted? The ideal situation is that you put as much force and speed through muscle fiber as you can, and you transmit the highest percentage of that. The easy way to think about this is, if we were to imagine a rubber band, since we use that analogy, right? So imagine I had holding it in one hand, and I pulled it back like I would pull a bow on the other hand, right? I let that go. That thing snapped. Okay, great. Now what happened? I used my hand, the energy in my hand, to pull that back. That cost me some energy physically, right?
Yeah.
Nothing happened in the rubber band. There's no ATP happening. There's no energy burning in the rubber band. When I let it go, it's just returning to its resting state. How do I make it return to its resting state faster? I pull it back farther, or I pull it back faster. That's going to determine my energy input, right? So what in muscle, in large part, what I'm doing is I am spending energy to pull that thing back to let it go. Right now, if I want to accelerate that, I let that rubber band go, and then I also push it with my hand. Right? I'm physically adding more energy into the system. This is the connection. This is the addition of muscle on top of tendon. Mm-hmm. So if we were to do another easy way to think about this is do a vertical jump. So if I said, okay, squat down a quarter of the way, hold the position for 3 seconds, and then jump without a counterbalance. What you're doing is you're taking all the kinetic energy that you put into your connective tissue, and since you're holding it for 3 seconds, it dissipates. The connective tissue is now out of gas. There's nothing there, right? If I were to take that rubber band and stretch it and pull it back and lock that in place and come back 3 years later and let that rubber band go, it wouldn't move. The energy dissipates, right? And so in that particular case, if you're squatting down and I ask you to jump up in the air, everything that's putting you up vertically is a byproduct of the muscle contraction. You have no connective tissue there. Counter, if I ask you to do what's called a counter movement jump, so you stand up normally and I just say jump and you take a little dip, you bounce as hard as you can, like you go down a little bit and then you jump up in the air. You've put the connective tissue, the rubber bands, on very fast stretch. They're going to respond by wanting to go back to their normal state as fast as they possibly can. So you got a quick stretch there. In addition to that, you also squeezed your hamstrings and your glutes and you extended your knee and your calf to add muscle contraction on top of it. And you double those things up and you jump much higher than you did if you were in a static hold. If I look at those two, in fact, I added even more. If I have you stand on a little box, 12 inches, 16 inches, you step off that box, land and jump as high as you possibly can. What I've done is I've taken and added even more energy into that rubber band.
Yeah.
That puts you on a greater, faster stretch. If I look at those three numbers, I can differentiate and tell how you produce force. Are you elastic? Are you muscle? Or are you in the middle? Because I can see the difference there. If, for example, your static jump is half an inch different than your counter movement jump, I can automatically tell, okay, great. You are not very effective at all with your connective tissue. Because you're able to produce almost the same amount of total force, or in this case, power, when I add connective tissue to the equation or when I take it out, it doesn't differentiate. Mm. You're not using your connective tissue at all. Mm. If it's the opposite, I can say, oh, okay, you're actually limited by muscular strength. Your connective tissue is fantastic. You over-rely on connective tissue. And what's likely to happen to that person? They're going to be more likely to have connective tissue soft tissue injuries.
Oh, because they're over. Okay, yeah, right.
They're hyper-reliant. They're
biased towards that.
Yeah. Yep.
They're like compensating with their connective tissue.
And that's just extremely simple movements like a vertical jump. Now, in an example you gave, which is like sprinting, now you are talking like left heel to right shoulder, mm-hmm. right? Because now we have cross lines that are going on anterior, posterior. You've got a lot of really interesting physiology, just actually anatomy happening there.
Yeah.
And so when you go from something as simple as like jump up in the air or deadlift or bench press, like really simple movements, and you try to put those into the context of human movement, like now things get really fun.
Yeah. Right. I wonder, this is not a helpful question, so I apologize in advance. But I wonder, I feel like there's a neglect of things like the lymphatic system and like the other systems throughout the body. Like when we think of the body, I think it's preferable to think of the body like a machine. Mm-hmm. And so with the machine, it's kind of like the pulley system,
yep.
you know, and it's like muscles, tendons, ligaments.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's any part of like, you know, if there's nerves that need to be flossed, you know, or if there's like the nerves that are bound or agglomerated or the connective yeah. tissue that's like just dense in and around other spaces,
yep.
which I guess just gets into the realm of connective tissue.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, health and function of the lymphatic system, health and function of the nervous system to allow that the actual like structural mechanical movement to be more effective. Not really asking anything. It's just something as we're talking about.
No, like musculoskeletal system. I have like, a bit of a semantic more. Argument with you.
Yeah.
But in concept, like you're right. The more that, so look, there's a difference in science between been studied thoroughly
mm-hmm.
and clear, like I hate debunk, right? That's not a real thing, but like it's been studied thoroughly and that thing doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Versus hasn't really been studied yet.
Yeah.
What you're talking about is more of the latter.
Right.
Which is just to say like, I don't know, but also we thought the same thing about acupuncture.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was bro science until it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We thought the same thing about hypnosis.
Yeah, right.
Total garbage until it wasn't. We thought the same thing about PEMF.
Mm-hmm.
Bro science until it wasn't. Like in that particular case, I don't think necessarily you've got like adhesions that need to be rolled out, but could you have some sort of
or like lymphatic blockage?
Yeah. I'm semantic with you here. Probably pedantic, more realistically.
Mm.
Not blockage. I don't think so. Suboptimal function somehow, some way. Yeah. Like it's not hard to logic your way into that one.
Mm-hmm.
Is there potentially some additional swelling or some sort of desensitization? Like something is happening there. It's like, I'm just picking at the words you're saying. It's like probably not those things.
Yeah.
But is that contributing to suboptimal like big, performance?
Dumb gorilla bro words. I apologize.
I mean, look, if you think about what the lymphatic system does, boy, it makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yep.
Yeah.
And it is certainly not as simple as how much force can your muscle fibers contract. That mm-hmm. is not how physiology works at all.
Yeah. Yeah. What is the fourth one? It's 9:26. You got to be out of here in the next.
Yeah. Like, 10 the minutes. Fourth one would be that training. Like that would be our fourth big one. It, mm-hmm. Making sure that we are training appropriately to build the connect as best we understand. Right. There is some data. You've probably covered a little bit of the role of like this kind of this combination of collagen and vitamin C. Mm-hmm. And potentially dark chocolate, like in there. More and more stuff is coming out on that. But really, training-wise, it seems to be, as we understand it, making sure that we are contracting over long positions. So you want to be long, you want to be strong, and then you know our work.
Long as in, like, long range of motion?
Yep.
Or long as in, okay.
Yeah. So you need to move your joints.
Like a stretched position.
Totally.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, your joints need to be moved over their full range of motion. It's different for every person.
Is there value in short range?
Of course.
Specific as well?
Absolutely. Like there's value in all of it, right? And this is why we are probably doing ourselves a disservice if we're only training in very specific ranges of motions and planes and type of actions and styles of a contraction. It's hard to make a cogent argument that any of those are optimal for global human movement. It'd be very difficult to make that argument.
What would your distribution be if your intention is to optimize or prioritize tendon and ligament strength? What would your distribution of, again, eccentrics or plyometrics or concentrics or isometrics? Or
it would entirely depend on where that person is on that continuum. Like, are they already super effective?
Yeah, right.
Or are they super ineffective? I would also say, what does their injury history tell you? And then what are they asking their body demands wise? What do they do throughout the day? Do they sit? Do they walk? Are they a farmer? Are they a parent? Like, are they in an office? Like, all those things are going to play into that equation. I don't think you need to go out of your way to spend a massive majority of your time on isometrics or eccentrics. But if you're looking at a joint and I'm watching your knee move and I'm like, oh, okay. It gets the wobbles.
Mm-hmm.
When we're asking it to move, it doesn't have stability. You can't hold a lunge position for 20 seconds without something shaking. All right. I don't need to move past that for a while.
Yeah. Right.
Like that is, you know, where is that 40 seconds, 60? I don't know. I mean, there's some people, there's an entire training idea that goes back a long time of isometrics for up to 5 minutes.
Yeah.
3 to 5 minute holding.
If you get comfortable on the bottom of a horse stance for 5 minutes, you're gonna be pretty good.
I did it for like an hour one time with Wim Hof.
An hour?
Yeah.
How did that go?
It was actually not hard at all, because like you kind of cheat, to be totally honest. Like you kind of shuffle. You
got like a stool?
No, you shift back and forth, like left to right.
Come on.
So it's kind of like.
Not hard at all.
Yeah, it's really, it was not that hard.
Well, maybe I guess if you like really, like you're like skandasanaing back and forth, like leg to leg.
Yeah, and it's not like, you're not in a great position, to be honest. It's like, they did it and I was like, I don't know here. And then I was doing it and I was like, oh, I'm kind of just like mostly standing and then like kind of shifting back and forth. Like it wasn't really that hard.
Standing in place for an hour would be really hard for me. I think I'd rather horse stance.
I'd rather sit on the couch and play video
Can
games.
I ask you a question that makes me sound smart?
I think all your questions have made you sound smart.
I appreciate that. Well, I mean, this is like a pseudo smart. I don't think this actually makes me sound smart. Is there some way to optimize the mobilization, if that's the correct term, of satellite cells within the muscle when training? Does that make sense? Is there some way, can we take a supplement? Can we train in such a way to really like instigate?
Testosterone. Yeah, for sure.
And what are satellite cells?
So satellite cells, the easy way to explain this is non-differentiated myonuclei, right? So they can do many things, but one of them is, so look, the very short answer, imagine you and I are in this building, and in this building, we've got different offices and companies and things like that. And there's one general manager for this building, right? But now you open up another building, instead of being in Austin, we open it up in New York. And you had the exact same general manager, and that person had an office right here. And then we opened one up in Chicago, and then we opened one up in Puerto Rico. It's like, we need to put somebody, we can have one manager here, but we'll be way more effective. What happens when all of a sudden someone shows up and the key breaks in the lock in Puerto Rico? Great. Yeah, you get the point here. Having more distributed managers that can make decisions makes things go faster, right? In the case of your tissue, this means you can read and regulate what's happening in there and you can respond. You can recover. You can say this insult happened. This allows you to grow, shrink, die, repair much faster. So there's one prevailing theory that says the absolute size of the muscle, hypertrophy, is regulated by the amount of myonuclei. It's called the myonuclear domain. And so what it says is your muscle will only grow such that the amount of space or area each nuclei is asked to cover or to manage is at a certain extent.
I like that.
It won't go any higher unless you add more nuclei.
If I lived in the body, I'd want to live in the myonuclear domain.
Yeah, right?
That'd be like a nice neighborhood.
Yeah, well, sort of, but like everything's always breaking. So you're kind of like a landlord who's just only being asked to fix shit. It's not.
But it sounds hard though. It'd be like living in New York. Like you have like that pride.
Totally.
You know it's hard.
Uh-huh. One of the things that testosterone does specifically, like testosterone supplementation, if you want to call it that, is that it increases that myonuclear pool.
Mm.
And so there you go. Like, in case you're wondering, testosterone works.
Any other clever ways of mobilizing stem cells in the body?
Any basic training will do that. So hypertrophy style training will get that going. The other thing you want to think about is just generally don't get in its way. So don't have suboptimal nutrition, suboptimal sleep, suboptimal endocrine profile. Like any of those things to subvert that is the problem.
What about having a long cry?
Not really sure that will help.
Bro, when I have a long cry, I feel like I'm mobilizing stem cells.
I can't speak to the science of that one.
I can feel it, bro.
Yeah. Those would be the primary ways. There are other potential stuff going on, but for the most part, the only issue to break your heart, it doesn't look like that myonuclear domain theory is actually going to pan out.
Nice.
So... yeah, I mean, what my general answer would be.
In relation to testosterone?
No, for sure we know that works. In terms of, that may not be the limiting factor to how much you grow.
Hmm.
It may be something else.
that we don't know.
Yeah. Well, there's a handful of things like ribosome. There's also these non-coding RNAs.
You think Liver King knows?
I don't know who that is. I'm not familiar with that individual. Has that person published any paper? No, I'm not familiar with the research. All right, never mind. Okay. So, yeah. Train appropriately. Eat appropriately. The best advice I can give you there.
All right. I appreciate you, man.
Always.
It's been a while.
Long time.
Long time. Where should people go from here? If they want to sleep better, they want to get their biomarkers sorted out, if they want to see where the heck they're at, how they're doing.
Yep. My social media is Science Communication for me. So if you just like hearing science and human performance, that's Instagram and Twitter are the most active places, only active places for me. Mm-hmm. And then our sleep company, Absolute Rest, we can do a whole bunch of really fun stuff. There we set up actual like full-blown sleep labs in people's houses, run a full clinical grade FDA approved sleep studies on people in their own bedroom.
And you will actually curl up at the end of your bed with you at night
for five days. No, I wouldn't do that. I might cuddle with you a little bit prior to sleep, but then I'm leaving so you can sleep in your own environment.
I get that. I respect that.
Yeah, that's especially according to my wife.
Yeah,
my god, that woman will not let me touch her at all. When it comes to like sleep time, she's like, no, you go in your side of the house.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. She's very much like, don't mess with my sleep.
We're the opposite.
Oh, yeah.
I'm very codependent.
When it comes to sleep?
Everything.
Oh, yeah. Her and I get along because we are both the opposite. I'm like, yo, don't touch me. She's like, great. I don't want to be touched.
Wow.
That is Absolute Rest. Depending on when you listen to it. When's this going to come out? Do you know?
Probably the next couple weeks.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So then perfect. Early, mid-July-ish or January-ish. Vitality blueprint, high performance blood work, which is, we don't have time really to get into, but this is not for health longevity. This is high performance stuff. So if you want to optimize, that stuff now, the way that it works is we have an extensive panel of things that we pull from. It is then, interpreted for you from the context of high performance. And then it is solved for you. So very high precision solutions based on that blood work. So you're not left on your own. Things like all I mentioned and many more. So blood work wise, that'll be coming out. And then of course, I just launched my education company in Thanksgiving, which is called Biomolecular Athlete. It's the first public course in education I've ever done, which is insane. We had over almost 100 people from over 100 countries buy the course. The very first course, which was nuts. So that's cool. Going, and we're releasing a couple of more courses on fatigue management and some other stuff this year. And then finally our full immersion coaching program at Rapid Health and Performance. So I'm all over the place, man.
You're a prolific mofo, Andy Galpin.
Yeah, man.
I appreciate you.
Likewise.
All right. That's it. That's all. We got to get you to the airport. Thank you so much for your time. And all the work you put in to be able to present all this information in such a cogent way. Thank you for tuning in. That's it. That's all. I'll see you next week.
Hope you guys enjoyed that conversation. If you did, drop us a review, share it with your friends. You can also check out the Align Podcast YouTube page where we share the videos for this and every other one, as well as instructional content. Subscribe over there. Subscribe here. And go hug your mom, dad, friends, tell somebody you care about them, make eye contact with the next barista you see, and hope you all are having an exceptional day. I will see you next week.